From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. There's a new movie coming out later this month called The Day After Tomorrow. The film imagines what global climate change might look like if we don't do anything about it. Tidal waves, lots of ice, not a pretty picture. Before it has even been released, the film has already stirred up controversy because many people, including some climate scientists, are saying that the movie distorts the science of global climate change in the service of a dramatic plot. This is an issue that comes up a lot because films are a common site for stories about the possibilities of scientific knowledge. There's a film out now called Godsend that imagines some of the darker and, in this case, a little bit ridiculous possibilities raised by the prospect of human cloning. In a different vein, the Sloan Foundation, which usually funds scientific research, is now financing a documentary about Hedy Lamarr, who, in addition to being an actress, was also an inventor who made some important scientific contributions. The question of whether a movie gets the science right is only one of many questions that we might ask about the connections between science and film. We might also wonder how films present the scientific process, or how films characterize the aims of science, the nature of scientific knowledge. We might also ask the question from another side, how does science present film? What uses have scientists and scientific institutions made of film and the cinema in pursuit of its own goals? Today on Odyssey's Film Forum, we're going to ask some of these questions as we explore the relationship between science and film. Joining us for the conversation here in Chicago is film historian Scott Curtis. Hello, Scott Curtis. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Gretchen.
Thanks for joining us. With us in Washington, D.C. is American Studies scholar Eric Drown. Hello, Eric Drown. Welcome back to Odyssey.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here again.
Good to have you. Eric Drown, get us started here. Films like The Day After Tomorrow and Godsend are both these dystopic nightmare visions related to science. If we look at sort of the broad spectrum of science movies, tell us how representative films like these are.
Well, I think, you know, they're representative of one or two of the subgenres that you could go put into a large category of science films. The disaster film surely is one of them, and The Day After Tomorrow is representative of that. But there are also films that we think of almost immediately when we think of science films, like Andromeda Strain, which are about the scientific process. In addition, other films that we don't usually think of as science films, like police procedurals, including films like Bone Collector, I think could be profitably understood as science films. Yes.
I was just going to say more about that because of the uses of science and technology in police procedures?
Yes. The Bone Collector is the film featuring Denzel Washington as a man who literally can't get out of bed because of previous injuries. And he must get a young woman to do forensic science for him. And lots of computer technology is used in the film. And at the same time, science is being used in order to examine the remains of victims in order to sort out who the criminal is going to be and how they're going to be brought to justice.
So you're expanding our categories pretty well beyond science fiction, I would say, in terms of what we might want to think about in thinking about science and film.
That's right. I think the question of science is, in our society as well as in our films, totally permeated almost every element of our existence, both on a kind of individual level and also at a kind of macro social level. I mean, as a result, you have to go beyond films like, you know, The Terminator or even Awakenings or, 2001, A Space Odyssey to sort of understand the role that science plays in not only our lives, but in the way Hollywood attempts to represent our lives.
Well, Scott Curtis, maybe you can push the boundaries a little bit further. If we were to look outside of commercial film, or in particular commercial narrative film, how might we continue to expand the category of science and film?
Well, scientists have always used motion pictures in a variety of different ways, and we can think about the intersection between science and cinema first at the simple level of documentary, right? We've got all sorts of documentaries do this work of investigation in the same way that Denzel Washington does. So you have public television, Nova, Discovery, Animal Planet, that sort of thing, nature films, travelogues, this sort of thing. They all have a sort of scientific bent to them. But then you could go even further and think about films that scientists make themselves in order to show each other, films that they make to record natural phenomena, for example, like taking time-lapse photographs of plant growth or cell division, or using motion pictures to explore the human body, like X-ray cinematography or something like that.
So we're talking now about a really broad range of intersections between science and film. I'm imagining a spectrum from, you know, doing science
right.
to showing science with not necessarily any scientific content, but I have a feeling that spectrum will break down as our conversation continues. Eric Drown, let me come back to you and ask about a particular piece of this. I'd like to know a little bit about scientists as characters in movies. Can you talk a little bit about the range of types or sort of possibilities for a scientist as a character in a movie?
Sure, and a lot of these are rooted more in science fiction than they are in actual scientific practice. And so let me start with a few that everybody will think about. One, the mad scientist, probably rooted in Frankenstein, both its literary and filmic representations. This mad scientist is one who is unconstrained by any social boundaries. Add to that maverick scientists, people who go beyond existing paradigms, for better or for worse. Bureaucratic scientists, people who only work within the paradigms and often have ulterior motives, whether they're for seeking power or for continuing the existence of certain kinds of institutions.
Can you give an example of that?
The administrative scientist?
Yeah, just a film.
Yeah, I think about Outbreak as a good example containing at least a couple kinds of scientists. One, the Dustin Hoffman character, the man who is going to work for the military, but also try to bring truth to the military in order to contain this Ebola virus outbreak, and then also his superior in the Army, who is interested in using Ebola as a kind of weapon and seeking to perpetuate military defense aims in that film. My favorite kind of scientist, though, is one that we don't usually think of, and that's the goof scientist. You see him everywhere, from Cary Grant bringing up Baby to Jerry Lewis and the Nutty Professor. And, you know, those guys should be thought of as one of the paradigms of science as well, scientists.
Sticking with scientists for a moment, Scott Curtis, you were saying before that scientists make films for each other, you know, to show each other. But scientists also sometimes make films for us, to show us about, or have, in the past at least, made films as a vehicle for popularizing science. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. Scientists have always, offered their results to the public in a variety of different ways. And there have been different class of scientists within the scientific community, too. I mean, we can't quite put them in terms of the goof scientist versus the maverick scientist, but we have research scientists, and then we have scientists who are more interested in popularization. And even in the 19th and 18th centuries, you had scientists traveling around the country, offering lectures that presented their work and presented the latest advances in scientific discovery. And with the coming of motion pictures in the late 19th century and early 20th century, you have that being used as a tool for popularization as well. And so they would, scientists would often make motion pictures of the phenomena that they're studying in order to show them to a lay audience. But then you would also have motion pictures that were made by larger companies like, regular film studios that were scientific, to be shown in their theaters as well, mostly in the early period.
So films about science.
That's right.
To be shown to the general public.
That's right. There's always been a strong connection between motion pictures and the popularization of science.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. We're talking today on the program about science movies, and we've just spent a little time broadening our notion of what we might think of as a science movie, from just science fiction or narrative films about science to films made by scientists to actually do science. Eric John, let's begin to talk about what sorts of ideas we're getting about science from these movies. You were talking before about science as, I think what you said was as a social practice. I might be misquoting you, but anyway, about the social elements of science in general. Say a bit more about that. What is it that you're interested in thinking about science movies? What sorts of social questions are you interested in?
Well, first, we do have to understand science in real life as a social practice. We often have this image of it as, a lone individual sort of working through inspiration and hard work and coming up with some radical idea that's going to change the way we think about the world. But in the real world, science is a collaborative process, and it depends as much on social networking and the ability to work within the established scientific societies and institutions in order to get its work done. And as a result, science is imbued with elements of politics and economics and cultural issues that we don't normally think of. And you begin to see this in films, and I think Godsend is a good example of it. It takes the character of the maverick scientist, Dr. Richard Wells, played by Robert De Niro in this case, and enables him to work outside of the boundaries of any kind of social control. An early discovery of his enables him to finance his own researches, and so he abandons an academic post and moves to a small town where he will be unconstrained by any kind of other social authorities like the police, like the government. And since he's financially well off, he doesn't have to get investors in his process. So right at the very heart of most science movies is the relationship between the scientific endeavor, the claim to scientific authority, and other forms of social authority.
Okay, so you mean positioning whoever the scientists are in the movie, positioning them within this milieu, like saying or explicating something about where they get their money and whose interests they're serving and what sort of position they see themselves as occupying.
That's right. And these are some of the most important questions that those of us who are not all that well versed in the technical aspects of science can ask of scientists in order to make sure that the work that scientists do while seeking a kind of truth is also serving the interests of a democratic society, for example.
Scott Curtis?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. In fact, the image of scientists often put them outside of these social circles, and this is something that is quite interesting in terms of the way the scientists use motion pictures in their own work as a way of working within that social circle, within the milieu of the scientific community, and how motion pictures, for example, are a way of convincing other scientists of the veracity of their work, of the accuracy of their observations, for example.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about veracity and accuracy and whether those questions, where they are in all of these other questions about science and film. Stay with us. There's a lot more to talk about today. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Chicago Public Radio is supported by the Chicago Historical Society, presenting a program on the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling on Brown versus the Board of Education. That's Monday, May 17th at 7 p.m. Information at chicagohistory.org.
Fair trade offers a living wage to farmers and workers in the developing world. I'm Jerome McDonald. Later today on Worldview, I'll discuss fair trade with the CEO of Transfair USA. They certify products as fairly traded in the U.S. I'll also talk with a fair trade coffee grower from Nicaragua. That's on Worldview later today at 1 on Chicago Public Radio.
This is WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, WBEW Chesterton 89.5 FM, and WBEQ Morris 90.7 FM, Chicago Public Radio.
listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. It's Film Forum on the program, and today we're talking about science movies. At the moment, there are a couple of science movies out there. There's Godsend, which is a movie exploring some of the darker possibilities of human cloning. There's also a movie that hasn't come out yet, but people are already a little bit up in arms about, called The Day After Tomorrow, which purports to show what sort of havoc will be wrought by global climate change if we don't do anything about it. Our guest today are Scott Curtis, who is a film historian at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He is currently at work on two books, one called Managing Modernity, Art, Science, and Early Cinema in Germany, as well as a book called Tangible as Tissue, Science, Medicine, and the Moving Image. He's with us here in Chicago. In Washington, D.C., we're joined by Eric Drown, who is a visiting scholar in the American Studies Department at George Washington University. He is at work on a book called Invention Culture, Reading Popular Science and Science Fiction in Modernist America. Eric Drown, let's come back and dig in a little bit on questions about veracity and accuracy and you know, where they are in this discussion of science and film. You were saying before that the social questions, the question of what kind of scientist is in this movie, that's a way in, a way for people outside of science to ask questions of scientists. But is it because we can't ask questions about science because we're sort of cut out from the actual science?
Well, I think that might be one of the problems. Contemporary science is really difficult. If you're not trained in advanced mathematics, how are you going to understand physics? Most of us don't know what the full periodic table of elements is. How are we going to participate in even elementary discussions of advanced chemistry today? So that is part of the problem. On the other hand, I think often scientists who want to use the cinema for their own public relations efforts often don't understand the language of narrative or the importance of the way fiction is structured and the way it works to help people think through things that they otherwise wouldn't be able to think through. So if you try to develop this idea a little bit more, narrative is a way of thought, and it's a way of bringing coherence to ideas that otherwise people wouldn't be able to think through.
Scott Curtis, from your vantage point of looking at films, particularly looking at films that scientists use, say a little bit about this connection between film and accuracy. I mean, what kind of a medium is film for conveying accurate scientific information?
Well, it has a variety of advantages that other technologies do not have. It provides a picture of an event through both time and space. That's different than photography, which is, you know, holding it still at a particular moment, or some graphic method, which does not replicate the entire movement of the object. So it has a variety of different advantages that scientists have latched onto over the past century. And indeed, the questions of objectivity and accuracy have all, at least since the late 19th century, seem to have been mediated by technology themselves. You know, what is objective or accurate? That's something that is outside the human body, outside of human fallibility, right? And so motion pictures as a mechanical object, as a technology that is in some ways independent of the body, while at the same time being very dependent upon it, gives an illusion of objectivity that scientists have been very much invested in from at least for the 20th century.
When you say an illusion of objectivity, do you mean that in filming a particular event that a scientist might be interested in studying, they can then tell themselves, here is the event?
Right, right. But what happens, I mean, and indeed, that is the event, and we don't want to say that it didn't exist outside of that filming. But in other ways, you know, certain events, such as events that are too slow to capture or too fast to capture, like a bullet slicing a card or cell division or something like that, these events are enabled, are actually seen, we see those events, the scientists observe those events only through the process of cinematography. And in that sense, their conception of that event is very much perhaps colored by that technology.
So in a sense, to grossly oversimplify perhaps, scientists know what they know because of, in part, because of the technologies of film. we know what they know in part because of technologies of film in different ways.
Right.
And if I can add one thing,
by all means.
Film exists because of scientists' ways of conceptualizing the optical properties of light waves and how you can use chemistry to create flexible film in order to get a motion picture in the first place. So the relationship between science and film is inherent in the medium itself. You can't avoid it.
Film is a scientific invention, and it's especially during the early days, it was sold as a scientific invention. It was publicized as a scientific invention. And now, even huge, big blockbusters like Day After Tomorrow are being used for scientific publicity. I mean, some scientists are upset about accuracy. Others are saying Day After Tomorrow might do for global warming what Jurassic Park did for dinosaurs.
Which is what? I don't know what Jurassic Park did for dinosaurs.
It popularized the whole idea. You know, if we can get global warming on the table in various conversations across the country, then people will start paying attention to it a little bit more, and they might be more interested in this topic than they were before this movie came out. Same thing with Jurassic Park, right? The whole dinosaur craze started with that, but it was at least extended by that, amplified.
Gretchen.
Yeah. I think a lot of scientists imagine that the greatest threat from the cinema is inaccuracy. But I think because they don't understand the language of narrative as well, perhaps as they might, they're missing the greater threat to science, and that is a kind of long-term, ongoing assault on scientific authority and the authority of scientists to pronounce that which is true. If you look at the history of cinema in the last 30 or 40 years, it's hard to pick a movie that really says scientists are the good guys who are going to bring utopia about and make it possible for a rational political process or a rational economic process to be developed. Even characters who might do that, as in the mathematician in A Beautiful Mind, are fatally flawed characters. And so we begin to wonder about the ability of scientists to deliver the promised progressive utopia of the future.
Well, so let me ask you to expand on that a bit. What other interests might we identify that scientists or the scientific community would have in film as broadly conceived as we want to think about it? But I'm thinking, Eric Drowne, in particular, towards the commercial narrative end of things. So their own authority, I mean, you talked about their own authority. Scott Curtis has mentioned, you know, popularizing what they do, perhaps galvanizing public support for what they do. Are there other interests that we can identify?
Well, I think, scientists are facing a kind of crisis in scientific authority. If you think about the withdrawal of support in recent years from large scientific programs, the closing down of the Super Collider Superconductor program, decline in funding for NASA, you can begin to see that not only have nation states begun to lower the funding for scientists, but the population in general has begun to remove its belief that scientists have the answers to a lot of questions that are not just about the nature of the universe. If you contrast that to the period after World War II, lots of Americans were confident that scientists were going to be able to answer the question. Despite the atomic bomb being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, many Americans believed that psychologists like Dr. Spock could teach them how to raise their children in order to be reasonable people. And other scientists were asked to provide expertise in things as intimate as sex and as things as sort of broad as rationalizing the economy.
Eric Drowne is a visiting scholar in the American Studies Department at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He is at work on the forthcoming book, Invention Culture, Reading Popular Science and Science Fiction in Modernist America. We're talking today on the program about science movies and some of the relationships between science and film. Our number, if you'd like to join in our conversation, is 888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. Give us a call if you'd like to ask a question, make a comment. We're also talking today with Scott Curtis, who is a film historian at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He is at work on the books Managing Modernity, Art, Science, and Early Cinema in Germany, as well as tangible as tissue, science, medicine, and the moving image. Scott Curtis, first of all, I wanted to ask you to weigh in on this interests question. Are there other interests that scientists or the science community might have in film that we don't have on the table yet?
No, I think we've got everything on the table in terms of their use of motion pictures to popularize, their use of motion pictures to investigate, and their interest in popular motion pictures as both publicity and as indication of threat. I think that last section is, or that last issue is kind of interesting, precisely because there is a decline in confidence in scientists and science as the possibility of providing the answers that we need, like Eric said. And you think that's something that goes with the end of World War II specifically. I mean, we still have a variety of scientists, as Eric mentioned, who provide those answers, but I think World War II itself changed people's perhaps perspectives on rationality and the uses that it could be put, specifically the Holocaust, right? That changed a lot of people's idea about how scientists behave in the world, and combine that with the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project, and questions of ethics came into issue as well.
Eric Drown, I'm wondering if we could maybe talk a little bit. I know you have some thoughts on the film Contact, which it's an interesting film because it puts side by side two dominant and different modes of thinking about the world. I mean, it puts science and religion right next to each other and in conflict there. Can you say a little bit about that, in particular with respect to this question of authority in science?
Sure. Contact, whether you think about it in book form or in film form, is evidence of the decline of scientists' moral authority. If you think back to the ethical questions around the dropping of the atomic bomb, the atomic scientists were primary figures in the arguments over whether or not the bomb should be dropped and what the moral effects of it were once it was dropped. Today, Contact stages morality as necessarily a discussion between science and other non-scientific forms of moral authority, like religion or philosophy or history or any of those other kind of places that we look to in order to learn lessons, in order to have a future. So if you think about Jodie Foster's character, in some ways she's an administrative scientist, and in some ways she's a maverick scientist, in some ways she's an outsider, right? She's a junior scientist whose ideas are not thought that well of, and yet it turns out that in some ways she's really right about things. And as a result, she's got some kind of credibility within the film. On the other hand, you have Matthew McConaughey's character, who is a kind of new Christian minister, who's able to use ideas from philosophy and science in order to buttress his faith. Between the two of them, they both represent hybrid characters. Remember in the film that Foster's character is agnostic and as a result is denied the seat in the ship that will take her across the universe. In the ship that will take her across the universe and to provide contact with the alien intelligence, because precisely she does not believe that religion can offer any meaningful answers to questions in the universe. By the time the film is over, however, she's gone across the universe, had an epiphany in incredibly personal terms that opens her up at least to the question that faith might be a meaningful way of approaching some ultimate questions. But the film ends not in the way that you would expect, with religion and science married to one another, literally in the figures of McConaughey and Foster. Rather, each goes their own way, and each has some respect and some sense of the other's importance, but neither ends up really having a lot of discussion with one another at the end.
And not necessarily refashioning what one could be a hybrid of. I mean, you're still stuck with science or religion, maybe some mix of the two, but not necessarily a new horizon of possibilities or a new
set. Right.
Okay.
The division of labor is such that science handles the questions of the natural world, and religion or the humanities or philosophy handles questions of meaning.
Let me jump in and give our number again. It's 888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. The number's toll-free anywhere in the U.S., so give us a call if you'd like to join in our conversation. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Scott Curtis, this question of possibilities, let me put it to you. Is film a way of reshaping the kinds of questions science can or should answer? You were talking before about the way film kind of fixes the way certain problems are understood because mm-hmm. you have a film of a particular event. But is there any way in which film sort of reshapes the boundaries of science?
I think so. I think that just the very fact of motion pictures, the very fact of the moving image itself, changes our conception of the how the world works in many ways. And I think this is expressed in science as well. Like I was talking about cell biology, for example. Historians of scientists have investigated how cell biologists have used motion pictures to take photographs of the cell division process, for example, and through that, because it's such a slow process, they have to use time-lapse cinematography. And so when they take these motion pictures, you eventually get a speeded-up process. You get something that is takes several hours, condensed into 9 minutes, say. And that gives you a different conception of time, space, and how cells behave. Right, and even though scientists might know, yeah, this is a condensation and not really the way it actually is, you can't help but think that we only access this knowledge through this. The idea of cell behavior itself is only possible through time-lapse cinematography, and hence the technology itself is shaping the agendas of scientists.
Because you can study a process, because you can capture a process mm-hmm. and look at it, a process then itself can become an object of study in a way that maybe it hadn't been before.
Exactly.
It's a really interesting thought. I also want to ask you whether the types of uses of film that scientists make of film work their way back, those very processes work their way back into films that ordinary non-scientists would see.
Yeah. In fact, it's funny because Day After Tomorrow probably has some set pieces, some disaster images, right, that are only possible because of certain special effects technologies that come back to scientific investigations. Or put it another way, there's many things in Day After Tomorrow, I'm sure, that are inaccurate from a scientific point of view, but those elements, those set pieces that they're using, probably were made simply because they could make them through this new CGI process or special effects technology. And so here we have a parallel situation where popular motion pictures are being driven by the process itself. The agenda or the narrative of the motion picture is being driven by the special effects process, that by the technology, in the same way that scientific investigation is sometimes driven by the technology as well.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take some calls. Our number is 888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. Give us a call if you'd like to join in our conversation today about science and film. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Chicago Public Radio is supported by Steppenwolf Theater Company, presenting I Never Sang for My Father. John Mahoney gives the performance of his career, says the Chicago Sun-Times, now playing through June 27th. Ticket information at 312-335-1650 or steppenwolf.org. Chicago Public Radio is supported by Wayland Academy in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, a college prep boarding and day high school dedicated to building knowledge and character through educational and extracurricular activities. Information on Wayland Academy is available at wayland.org.
WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM, WBEW Chesterton, 89.5 FM, and WBEQ Morris, 90.7 FM.
Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today on the program, we're talking about science and film. There are a couple of science movies out right now, both of which are looking at issues in contemporary science. Godsend is a movie about human cloning. There's also The Day After Tomorrow, which comes out later this month, which looks at scenarios of global warming. Our guests today for our conversation are Scott Curtis, who's a film historian at Northwestern University, and Eric Drown, who is a visiting scholar in American Studies at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Our number once again is 888-859-1800. 1-888-859-1800. Let's take a call. Let's talk with Jason. Hello, Jason. You're on Odyssey.
Hi, Gretchen.
Hi.
My problem with movies like Godsend are they sort of show science as a scary thing, and the only way they can connect science to sociology or philosophy or theology is through fear and sort of like this Pandora's box idea. And I think things like this are kind of keeping science, from progressing, because we're not seeing it as a part of society or as a part of philosophy. Things like religious authority sort of like to keep science in a box. And I'm just wondering if there's any sort of films that, Scott can recommend that sort of, like Contact, that show science as an unscary and sort of very necessary thing to think of.
Scott Curtis?
Back in the 50s, you had all sorts of films like that. Forbidden Planet, science fiction films that that show science as a something that explores the frontier specifically, and that brings that science back home to so that's one possibility. Eric probably has more.
Eric, yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Sure.
I
think I'd recommend at least three films that I can think of off the top of my head. One, Destination Moon, based on a Robert Heinlein movie novel, where human beings have to get off the planet. It's our destiny. It makes us sort of curious. It keeps us going, and progress is ensured by pursuing science. Then in the 70s, I'd look at Andromeda Strain. I mean, this is administrative science at its best. A virus comes from out of space, threatens to wipe out out of space, threatens to wipe out a significant number of the population on a planet. Scientists working as a team and very kind of plotting science almost avert the disaster. Thankfully, the virus mutates on its own and becomes less threatening. At the same time, this is a good representation of the way science works and why it's necessary. And finally, The China Syndrome, I think, is really good, not in its explicit representation of scientists, but in the way that activists can use science in order to even shut down some of the most threatening aspects of scientific technology. So I'd have a look at those.
But let me throw out a thought about Godsend. I mean, isn't it possible to say that, a movie like Godsend actually makes an argument for the socializing of science? That the problem is that this guy is cut off, that the scientist is cut off from his fellow scientists, from the larger community. I mean, there's lots of ways in which these people are isolated in this movie. They're in a nice small town. They cut off all connection with their family. And so lots of ways in which they're doing this in isolation, and it seems to be suggesting possibly that that's the problem, that you don't want to do it in isolation. And especially I'm thinking in contrast to a movie like Contact, where there are scenes of like congressional hearings about the project. I mean, it couldn't be more social, more embedded in the political and social process.
That's right. And it's not even just that science needs to be embedded in the social process, but that there are other sources of scientific knowledge. If you look carefully at the movie, you'll notice that...
Godsend? You're talking about Godsend?
Yes, Godsend, okay. Right. Greg Kinnear's character, Paul, is a biology teacher. He represents what I, following Michel Foucault, would call a subjugated knowledge. That is an a kind of lesser form of knowledge that is nevertheless important. And throughout the movie, he's constructing an alternate theory of what's happening to the boy as the cloning procedure goes on. And as a result, it turns out that he's right. His theory is the one that's the right one, not the medical doctor who, you know, admittedly has some self-interest there. And as a result, science needs to take into account, the movie suggests, those opinions of people who have alternate sets of ideas. In the real world, this happens with alternative therapies for AIDS and cancer and things like that. People who have really pushed the agenda for scientific research by refusing to accede to the authority of scientists. This could be a positive message out of Godsend that scientists could learn from.
Let me give our number again. It's 888-859-1800. Let's take a call. Let's talk with Jack. Hello, Jack. You're on Odyssey.
Yes, I just wanted to point out that in the most recent edition of Star Trek, which is called Enterprise, it's on every week, you can still see the Enterprise banking in space as though there's an atmosphere. In spite of the fact that we've already gone to the moon, sending probes to other planets, people who put out Enterprise know that the scientific literacy of many Americans is so poor that they can still get away with that the way they did in the 30s and 40s. So until that improves, they can use the wonderful new special effects that we have to perpetuate a lot of the same myths that they've always perpetuated.
What do you think about that, Scott Curtis?
Well, I think that there is a sense in which motion pictures or movies, commercial films, and television shows do perpetuate ideas or popular ideas about science and scientific phenomena. On the other hand, they're not alone in that. And it's been a long and hallowed tradition, actually, going back to Jules Verne, for example. And so the idea that that these particular objects, narratives, novels, motion pictures, television shows, should hone to a specific scientific line, be completely scientifically accurate, kind of misses the point about what they're supposed to be doing in the first place, which is entertain and provide a kind of alternate escapist universe, sometimes literally, in the case of Enterprise. So I think that it's kind of like the relationship between film and history, right? Historians are often complaining about the accuracy of historical epics. I'm sure we're going to hear about that with Troy coming out this Friday, or even today, I think, right? And so we're going to hear a lot about that. But that's always been cinema's purview, or at least it's taken it as its right to change history and change physical law because it can, and we enjoy it when it does.
Eric John, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I would add that there's a strong cultural tradition within science fiction itself of readers and viewers critiquing the science in these movies, just like our caller just did. And I think this is really a strong sign of the degree to which people take science seriously. There is a strong subculture of people who are irritated by this, but also who use this as an opportunity to play, and then also who use it as an opportunity for thinking about the role that the media has, for example, in shaping people's ideas, not just about science, but in other ways as well.
So in other words, the accuracy question, you know, is this film accurate, it can actually be a way to, whether purposely or not, a way to open up or inaugurate a dialogue about the science that's in the movie, about the claims the movie's making about scientific possibility or scientific significance.
Right, and I would encourage anybody who's interested in seeing this kind of practice in action to point their browser to badastronomy.com, where they can get lots of examples of the ways that people are using contemporary movies to critique science and therefore demonstrate their own knowledge of science and to deal with larger questions as well.
We're talking today on the program about science movies, the relationships between science and film. You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Let's take another call. Let's talk with Arthur. Hello, Arthur. You're on Odyssey.
Hello, Gretchen. Thank you. I wasn't able to listen to your whole show, so I'm not quite sure if this has been addressed. But I do agree with your guests regarding the role of movies in science. I do think it's meant to be educational and inspirational and providing a format for people to question science and what's going on in our world. And I'm wondering if part of the problem hasn't so much to do with films and how they represent science, but the general media in general, newspapers and news programs, generally more local news programs, and I suppose even the national news, not NPR, but television, how they represent science and scientists.
Okay, let's talk about that. Scott Curtis, I mean, are we isolating film excessively here?
Yeah, I think we are. I think that motion pictures are just one example, probably the most visible example because of their, you know, the publicity that's involved in it and the event-like status of a motion picture. But you can take any media example, such as like our caller mentioned, news shows, and how they represent science as very often something that will either, on one hand, cure you and everything will be completely fine, or on the other hand, present another threat. And so the polarization of issues within the media is probably what the caller is, you know, addressing here, and how scientists are often portrayed as either, mavericks, like Eric said, or goofs. And so this is one of the issues that is not unique to motion pictures.
Well, Eric Drown, are there issues that are unique to motion pictures?
That wasn't what I was expecting you to ask. my response to the question was going to be to think about the nature of popular science journalism as a field.
Yeah.
So if
yeah,
I can do that,
sure,
I'd feel better. thanks. So if you think about what popular science journalism has to do, one, it has to be interesting to a broad readership, and two, it has to make the science understandable. And as a result, most popular science journalism takes the form of some kind of narrative. And as a result, you need interesting characters, and you need to have a sequence of events that can be linked causally in some way to resemble a plot. So what do you get? You get stories of great figures and eureka moments, intellectual conflicts, stories of obstacles overcome. And as a result, you know, the broader question of the way science is represented comes down to the kind of cultural resources that we have for talking about science, which in some ways is really a non-narrative topic, right? That narrative is not particularly good at representing.
Let's take one last call before the end of the hour. Let's talk with Mark. Hello, Mark. You're on Odyssey.
Hi.
Hi.
My question had to do with the popularization of science in general, or more important, the lack of. I know we have movies like these that we're talking about on the show here, but real science in general doesn't seem to make very well or have very good inroads into popular culture. When you hear it on the news, it's always like the last story. Although at the same time, America seems to be in some ways obsessed with science, like the Mars missions or even technology in general, the gadgets that we all carry around, et cetera. And I'm wondering, like, why there's no maybe advertising dollars to go to? Why isn't this more in our culture, just science in general?
Eric Drown, go ahead and respond as you will, but let me sort of put a spin on that question. Is it you were just saying that making science into narrative is a bit of a problem. Would you say then that film is not a good medium for popularizing science?
Right. I think that's true. And in addition, I think there are good ways of using visual culture to represent science. But you have to think outside the box a little bit. I think some of the best examples of the way visual culture has been used to represent science can be found in the world of art. I'm thinking especially of Cubism and Jackson Pollock. Right, Jackson Pollock's drip paintings, and we often forget the titles of them. Sometimes they're just a number, but sometimes they're titles like Lavender Mist. Right, and if that's the case, then in some ways you can think of Jackson Pollock's paintings as obliterated landscapes, right? As landscapes painted through the lens of, you know, subatomic particle physics, for example, or through a landscape blown up by an atomic bomb. That might be one way of thinking about it. Cubism also, think about Nude Descending a Staircase. If you compare that to Edward Muybridge's serial photographs, which a lot of film scholars attribute as being one of the most important precursors to the cinema, you can see something really similar there. A lot of Moy Bridges' sequence studies were of a nude woman moving, and they look very much like nude descending a staircase. So there are ways in which visual culture can represent science, not scientific knowledge necessarily, but the insights of science, the spirit of science.
All right, we will have to stop there for today. Eric Drown is a visiting scholar in the American Studies Department at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He is at work on the forthcoming book, Invention Culture, Reading Popular Science and Science Fiction in Modernist America. Scott Curtis is a film historian at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He is at work on two books, Managing Modernity, Art, Science, and Early Cinema in Germany, and Tangible as Tissue, Science, Medicine, and the Moving Image. Scott Curtis and Eric Drown, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Gretchen.
Thanks very much.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, Neil Verma, our intern, Maura Waltz, and our production assistant, Ragnar Anderson. Our technical producer is Steve Warnauskas. Our program is produced by Allison Cuddy and Delia Lloyd. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Funding for Odyssey is provided by a generous grant from the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.